So I'll be reading from Joshua chapter 5, starting from verse 13 and going to the end of chapter 6. Alright, Joshua chapter 5, verse 13. Now when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" "Neither," he replied, "but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" The commander of the Lord's army replied, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did so. Now the gates of Jericho were securely barred because of the Israelites. No one went out and no one came in. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its king and its fighting men. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have the whole army give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse and the army will go up and everyone straight in." So Joshua, son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and have 7 priests carry trumpets in front of it." And he ordered the army, "Advance, march around the city with an armed guard going ahead of the Ark of the Lord." When Joshua had spoken to the people, the 7 priests carrying the 7 trumpets before the Lord went forward, blowing their trumpets, and the Ark of the Lord's Covenant followed them. The armed guard marched ahead of the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard followed the ark. All this time the trumpets were sounding, but Joshua had commanded the army, "Do not give a war cry, do not raise your voices, do not say a word until the day I tell you to shout. Then shout." So he had the ark of the Lord carried around the city, circling it once. Then the army returned to the camp and spent the night there. Joshua got up early the next morning, and the priests took up the Ark of the Lord. The 7 priests carrying the 7 trumpets went forward, marching before the Ark of the Lord and blowing the trumpets. The armed men went ahead of them, and the rear guard followed the Ark of the Lord, while the trumpets kept sounding. So on the 2nd day, they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. They did this for 6 days. On the 7th day, they got up at daybreak and marched around the city 7 times in the same manner, except that on that day, they circled the city 7 times. The 7th time around, when the priest sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the army, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab, the prostitute, and all who are with her in her house shall be spared, because she hid the spies with them. But keep away from the devoted things, so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise you will make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord and must go into his treasury." When the trumpet sounded, the army shouted, and at the sound of the trumpet, when the men gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed. So everyone charged straight in, and they took the city. They devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with the sword every living thing in it, men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep, and donkeys. Joshua said to the 2 men who had spied out the land, "Go into the prostitute's house and bring her out, and all who belong to her, in accordance with your oath to her." So the young men who had done the spying went in and brought out Rahab, her father and mother, her brothers and sisters, and all who belonged to her. They brought out her entire family and put them in a place outside the camp of Israel. Then they burned the whole city and everything in it. But they put the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute, with her family and all who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho. And she lives among the Israelites to this day. At that time, Joshua pronounced this solemn oath, "Cursed before the Lord is the one who undertakes to rebuild this city, Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son, he will lay its foundations, At the cost of its youngest, he will set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the land.
Okay. Sounds like it wasn't too disturbing. Well, I suspect that all of us have our problems with the ways of God. Whether you're a Christian or not, if you're a Christian, you know God, you know his amazing love and generosity in Jesus, and yet there's things about the way God does stuff that you're uncomfortable with, especially, I suspect, when it comes to pain of any sort whatsoever. How can pain and God's love coexist at the same time? If you're not a Christian, I presume it's at least in part because you have some issues with the ways of God. Your life, I guess, is still your life. God is not your God, Jesus is not your Lord, because there are things about God that you're not comfortable with. Have you ever had that absurd thought? You know, if I was God, I'd do it much better. Free ice creams every day. All my assignments would get HDs. The weather would always be brilliant. People would think I was cool, the coolest person in the world. You know, if I was God, I could do a much better job. Absurd, because you're not. But whatever your problems with God, I suspect that you meet one version of them in this passage. Have a look at chapter 6, verse 21. 6:21, they devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with the sword every living thing in it, men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep and donkeys. This is part of the conquest of the land of Canaan by the people of Israel at the command of God. And we meet here the thing that, I guess, in history has been the most objectionable part of the Bible. I don't think I can read this, and I suspect many others can't as well, without being deeply disturbed by what happens. This is a military invasion. It's the aggression on the part of Israel, like Japan moving into China and down towards Australia in the Second World War. And although the donkeys being killed don't worry me that much, the children, the women, the old people, the population of Jericho, every single one cut down. This is one step on the way to the summary that we get in chapter 10. I'll just read a couple of verses for you. Joshua subdued the whole region, including the hill country, the Negev, the western foothills, the mountain slopes. He left no survivors. He totally destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. This is genocide, isn't it? This is a whole population being wiped out. This is rivers of blood flowing. We've seen it many times in the last 100 years or so, the Holocaust, Bosnia, Rwanda, Cambodia. And here is another appalling, horrific, barbaric incident of, it seems, racism. And it happens with God's sanction. It's as God commanded. This sort of thing brings the response of someone like Richard Dawkins. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. Petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynist, homophobic, racist, infanticide, genocidal, filicidal, megalomaniac, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. I think he doesn't like him. But you can understand, in the light of this passage, why he might say such a thing. Another friend of mine said to me one time, such a being is not worthy of my worship, only of my contempt. Oh, how do we cope with this? How do we respond to it? Some people say, well, maybe the God of the Old Testament sort of changes by the time the New Testament. The God of the New Testament of Jesus is much more cuddly and loving and gentle. But how many gods do you think there are? Do you think they actually sort of sub in and sub out like a footy team? No, there's only one God. Some have concluded then that God must be racist. He's anti-Canaanite, he's pro-Israelite. That's the only way to explain it. Well, that question is actually asked by Joshua. This funny little thing in chapter 5 where Joshua meets this man who turns out to be the commander of the Lord's army. In fact, I think he turns out to be the Lord God himself. And Joshua says, well, whose side are you on? Are you on the Canaanite side or our side? And you expect the person to say, oh, of course I'm on your side. But he doesn't. He says, neither. No. The Canaanites can't object that God is unfair. The Israelites can't gloat that they've got God in their pocket. Despite superficial appearances, this is not racism, as we're going to see. Well, let's actually follow what happens. Jericho, the city just on the west side of the Jordan River that the people of Israel crossed, as we saw last week, is tightly shut up like a clam. You can't get in, you can't get out. It's got thick walls, all the gates are locked. It looks unassailable, but with God around, nothing is unassailable. And God dictates his battle strategy to Joshua and to the people. It's a very interesting battle strategy. In terms of military precision, it seems a bit wacko. His plan is for the people of Israel to march around the city once a day, for 6 days, seventh day, march around seven times, and then shout. Now, you can imagine the soldiers among Joshua's crowd going a little, well, confused at this. You want us to march around the city? I mean, I like processions, but I don't like them that much. Surely a few battering rams would be more effective. You want us to shout at the walls? Come on, so let's scale the walls. At least then we might make some progress. And you say the priests are going to lead, do you? Blowing trumpets. Yeah, this is going to work. Not. Well, they try it. Joshua directs the people. They march around the first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day, the fifth, the sixth. By the seventh day, I presume the people in Jericho are getting slightly bemused by what's going on. Probably throwing stuff at them if they're within throwing distance. But they march around seven times on the seventh day. Then they shout and the walls collapse. And what was shut up tight like a clam is now defenceless. Like a bloke caught with his pants down. And all of Israel rushes in and they kill, they slaughter everyone and everything in sight. It's a story that is often told to children. A lovely story from the Bible, but it really should be at least M-rated, shouldn't it? The violence, the blood, the gore. There's no way to lessen the horror of what happens. But notice the role of the ark as it was read to us. Do you see that? The ark is actually the thing that leads them around and around. The ark that we saw last week is the ark of the covenant of God, the promise of God, the commitment of God to the people of Israel. That is, this is not some isolated tragedy from ancient history, a few people sort of getting a bit beyond themselves. This is part of God keeping his promises to Abraham. It's a step in the way to the blessings that God promised all people through Israel. But the big question for us, I think, is why? Why this massacre? Why this slaughter? Well, the first thing to say is that the promises of God have always got two sides to them. The promise God made to Abraham, to bless Abraham, has a negative side as well. I'll bless those who bless you, but whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. If God is going to bless Israel, then that's got implications for others. If you side with Israel, that's positive. If you oppose Israel, though, then God will oppose you. And most promises are like that. 30 years ago, I promised to protect my wife. That means if you attack her, I will take action. I might look puny, but you attack Rosemary and you'll see what I'm made of. So that sort of promise inevitably has two sides. You can't keep one without the other side being true as well. If God promises Israel peace and security to bless her, then God will take action against anybody who disturbs that peace. Have you ever asked that question? Why hasn't God stopped all the pain? Why hasn't he cleaned up this mess that exists across the world? So life was good and pleasant and all that I want it to be and expect it to be. Well, what would God need to do in order to achieve that? He'd actually have to eradicate all evil, wouldn't he? All selfishness, all pride, all, well, everything else, greed, jealousy, anger, lust. He'd have to get rid of all of that. Now, what would he need to do to get rid of all of that? It gets a bit personal at that point, doesn't it? Because I'm implicated in that evil. For God to eradicate all evil, he's got to do something about me. For God to create a perfect situation, he's got to get rid of everything that wrecks that perfection. Like us. Now, God has promised he will one day. There will be salvation, full, total, a new creation. All that life is meant to be, but that will involve, on the flip side, judgment. It's two sides, really, of the same coin, of the same action. You can't have one without the other. But you could say to me, hold on, Tim. In this situation, Israel's the aggressor. Israel's the one going in, doing the slaughtering. And Canaan hasn't done anything, have they? They're just there. They're just sitting there, doing nothing. Let's look a little bit further then. Of course, there's things that we don't see in this passage that are part of the background. For example, about 600 years before this incident at Jericho, God spoke to Abraham. Abraham, the one he promised to bless and bless all the nations of the world. And God says to Abraham, I'm going to give your descendants this land of Palestine, of Canaan. But not yet. In the fourth generation, after they go down into Egypt, your descendants will come back here. And here's the reason. Because the sin of the Amorites, the sin of the Canaanites, has not yet reached its full measure. Do you start to see what God's saying here? He's saying, I will give you the land, but I'm unwilling to give it to you at the moment. Why not? Because the sin of the Canaanites, the Amorites, is not yet sufficient for me to judge them with the sort of completeness that's needed for you to have the land. So it's not that God promises Israel the land and says, well, I don't actually care about the people who are living there. They're just an inconvenience. They get in my way. I'll just sort of move them off, shuffle them out of the way. Now, God is unwilling to act unjustly. This destruction now, centuries later, is God's judgment on their evil. And that evil is attested to in the Bible in many places, especially through Deuteronomy. But it's also attested to in our archaeology. The cruelty, the witchcraft, the astrology, the prostitution, the rape, the human sacrifice that characterised those cultures was synonymous with evil even in its own day. And we see that by what he says in verse 21. It's not that you're to go and take what you can. This is not a pillaging exhibition. You are to kill everything, destroy everything except that which can't be destroyed, which you don't keep, you put into the Lord's sanctuary. It's under total destruction. It's under a ban. It's not that God simply wanted Israel to have the city and the inhabitants were inconvenient. No, the people in the city itself for its evil, is under the curse and condemnation of God, destined for destruction because of their behaviour. This is God's judgment on Jericho for her evil. And he uses Israel as his instrument. They deserve it fully. But at the same time, God is fulfilling his promise to give Israel the land so they can live peacefully, securely in the land. And if any people in the history of the world need to learn this lesson, a military conquest in itself doesn't bring peace. Just look at Iraq, look at Afghanistan. If you leave people there alive and well, you only build in resistance and guerrilla warfare. God waits and waits and waits till the people deserve to be totally destroyed. And then he does it through Israel to fulfil his promise to give Israel peace in the land. So why the massacre? This is God executing his judgment on the Canaanites, on Jericho and her inhabitants. That's why. Now, how do you respond to that? You're sitting there saying, oh, great, okay, that solves my problem. You're feeling comfortable now. This massacre is a good thing. I'm glad it happened. I suspect not. It's not quite as easy as that, is it? Why not? Well, I suspect because our real problem is not what happened in Jericho. Our real problem is that God judges at all. That's our problem. We prefer God to be, well, like Santa Claus. Santa Claus, a jolly, cuddly old man who gives presents to everybody, and the worst thing he'd ever do is give you a few less presents because you've been really naughty. But he's really just a nice, innocuous, imaginary person. But God is not Santa Claus. He's real for a start, and he's just. God does judge evil. God takes action to destroy evildoers. In other words, saying this is, in a sense, we don't like God being God. We want to judge and condemn him for what he does, but he is God and I'm not. He is God and you're not. And we see here that God does and will judge evil. Let me make six quick comments about this. Hopefully it'll help you understand it a bit more. The first one is, judgment is essential to our humanity. So imagine that there's no judgment. It's a little bit like handing in your assignment and it doesn't get marked. Now, sometimes that's a relief. But ultimately, I think you'd be disappointed, wouldn't you? You put that effort in and all the effort goes to waste. Your lecturer does not think your effort is worth marking, which means you're not worth anything. Your effort is insignificant. It's meaningless. And if our lives are like that, it really makes no difference whether I do evil or good, whether I rape somebody or help them, whether I cheat on them or assist them. Because in the end, there's no difference. It makes no difference in eternity if God does not judge. For our significance as people, for your decisions to have any value whatsoever, there must be judgment. God must be the judge of what we do. Secondly, judgment is essential for God's goodness. If God does nothing about the evil in this world, then surely, in a sense, he's evil. Justice is a funny thing. We often think of justice as being sort of, I don't know, blind, it's impartial. But justice comes from love. Justice is actually an expression of love. How do I know that? Well, think about it this way. Imagine that you attacked Andrew Lamb. Okay, you went for him. You really wanted to do him damage. And I care about Andrew. If I've got love for Andrew and you do that and you damage him, what am I going to do? I'm going to seek justice, aren't I? To be indifferent to what you do, say, oh, go ahead, bash him up, stick a few knives into him, that's okay. That sort of indifference shows lack of love.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, I'm not going to try it. Justice is distributed love. It says, I love you and you and you and you, and so if anybody hurts you, if anybody threatens you, I will do something about it. That is what justice is. Today in the newspaper came this report. A second man has been arrested for the imprisonment, torture and rape of a 5-year-old girl in Delhi. A second disturbing case that's brought thousands of protesters onto the Indian capital streets, and rightly so. The pair is accused of kidnapping the girl, holding her hostage in a locked apartment of the building where she lived. She was held for almost 40 hours, that's almost 2 days. A 5-year-old, repeatedly raped, tortured, including being raped with a candle and with a bottle. She was found when neighbours heard her cries. Can you read that and be indifferent? Can God see that and be indifferent? If God is good, he will do something, won't he? If God doesn't act with justice, he is not good. It's hard to imagine that happening without crying. It's hard to imagine that happening without crying out to God to bring justice. No, judgment is essential for God's goodness. Thirdly, God's judgment is the only hope for many victims of evil. See, in this life, many things, there is no justice. There are so many people, there are so many people who have been have suffered at the hands of vicious dictators and greedy con artists, and the con artists just enjoy their wealth and die happily and comfortably. Their only hope of justice is that God will act at the end of this life, at the end of history. Fourthly, God does not delight in his judgment and destruction. We saw that in Genesis 15, don't we? God is not saying, listen, I just can't wait to get my hands on these dirty people. I've got to really give it to them. No, God patiently, long-sufferingly, reluctantly brings his judgment. He has no joy in the death of a sinner. Fifthly, God brings some judgment within human history. That is, now and then justice is done in the world. Sometimes people act like through our court system to bring justice, because God has given us that gift. Other times God acts like he does here against the people of Jericho and brings judgment upon them. But most judgment is reserved for the final judgment. There's a couple of things to note about this, I think. The first one is these judgments within history are actually important for us. So imagine I came to you and said, listen, at the end of history, God is going to judge every person in this world for how they've lived. And you look at the history of the world and say, well, he's never done it yet. Why would you believe me? I don't think you would believe me. There'd be no reason to believe that God would take action at the end of history if he's never taken action during history. But he has taken action. Drastic, real action like this. All the inhabitants of Jericho and all the surrounding cities slaughtered, killed. Do you believe there'll be a final judgment? Look at this and be convinced. There will be a final judgment. The second thing is that the final judgment will actually be much worse than that. Sorry, I've actually missed a slide, I think. Let me read to you from Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10. Just listen to the words of Jesus. He says, "And don't be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell." We do fear those who can kill the body, don't we? Somebody puts a sword between your ribs, you'll be frightened. Somebody threatens to set off a bomb at the end of the marathon, you'll be scared, won't you? Jesus knows that that's true, but he says that's actually nothing compared to the way we should feel about final judgment, God's final judgment. There is something far worse than a quick sword between the ribs. The Bible's sketchy on the details, but what is clear is that final judgment hell will be endless anguish. If you're horrified at Jericho, that's mild in comparison to what God will do to those who are evil. Now, if you struggle to believe that, look at Jesus. The night before he's crucified, he prays this: "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." Sorry, he says that to his disciples. And then he prays, "Abba, Father, everything is possible. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." Jesus faces the prospect of judgment and hell. That's what he'll go through the next day. And if the hearts of the people of Jericho were melting in fear at the Israelite army, Jesus' whole being is melting in fear and anguish. Hell is real. Jesus has been through it for us. And he revolts against that possibility. Sixthly, God won't wuss out. I think for many of us, we just think, well, God's just sort of playing a bit of a game with us. He keeps threatening us with stuff, but he'd never actually do it. Look at this. He did it back then. He will do it. Judgment is real. And the Bible is not embarrassed about God's judgment. It's a right thing. It's a good thing. Without it, everything in life becomes meaningless. But it still seems a bit unjust, doesn't it? Imagine, you know, maybe the Canaanites deserved it, but is Israel actually squeaky clean? Are they much better? It still seems God is playing favourites. You know, if you're an Israelite, all's good. If you're a Canaanite, well, bad luck. But remember back in chapter 5, whose side are you on? Neither. And we see that reality played out in two little cameo appearances of Rahab and Achan. Remember Rahab? We met her, well, you met her in your Bible studies, you've done it, back in chapter 2. She hid the sides. Who is she? She's a Canaanite and she's a prostitute. She's guilty of the very sins that bring God's judgment. But she throws herself on the mercy of God. She throws her lot in with God and his people, and she is spared. Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies. And she lives among the Israelites to this day. In fact, she enjoys all the privileges of being an Israelite. She becomes the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of Jesus himself. Is God against Canaanites because they're Canaanites? No. And then there's Achan, who we'll meet in chapter 7. You might see, look at him in your faculty Bible studies if you're in them. He's an Israelite, not a Canaanite, but he blatantly disobeys God and he comes under the judgment of God. Rahab is spared. It shows that the God who judges Jericho has no delight in doing it. What disturbs us disturbs God. He's not anti-Canaanite. All could have been spared. Their fate is not sealed by their race, but by their persistent opposition. And then there's Achan. God is not simply pro-Israel. Being Israel doesn't save him when he does evil. So let me finish by encouraging you to consider the kindness and the sternness of God. Sternness to those who fell, that is, fell from faith, but kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness. If you're not yet a Christian, I encourage you to consider the sternness of God. God will judge you. Your life will be laid bare before him. He will give you what you deserve if you continue in your ways of suppressing the truth and living as if you're God of your life. But consider too the kindness of God. If you turn to God and put your trust in him, if you ask him for mercy, he will forgive you. He'll wipe your slate clean and welcome you into his family. It doesn't matter what race you're from. It doesn't matter how far you've gone, how much evil you've done. consider the kindness of God. And if you're a Christian, consider the kindness of God, that though we are sinners, he's redeemed us. He's at the cost of his own son, of Jesus. He went through hell so that we can escape hell. Mull it over. Think about it. Meditate on it. Thrive on it. Draw back to it daily. But also, consider the severity of God. Don't presume on God's kindness as if it's a license just to be evil again, to get away with anything and everything. Now let God's severity push you back to God's kindness so you experience it again. And my guess is there's questions out of this for you. Let's talk over afternoon tea. Of course, we've run out of time to have open questions now. I'll hand back to Divya.